Talkback Gardening with Sophie Thompson and Troy Sincock.
Filling in for Deb Tribe on 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And a very good morning to you. It is wonderful to have Sophie Thompson in the studio with us. What a rarefied moment this is.
Good morning, Troy, and good morning, listeners.
It's uncommon for you to be here on a Saturday, but you've been expecting something, and we're not quite sure whether that's actually going to happen while you're here.
Absolutely. There's something very special about to go off, off being the relevant word, in the Botanic Gardens. And so we are going to talk with Matt Coulter. Now, Matt is the horticultural curator at the Botanic Gardens and Herbarium of South Australia. I can't remember what term I gave him earlier, but it certainly wasn't dignified.
Big Daddy, I think
Big
it was.
Daddy, so we'll be talking to Matt about this amazing corpse flower.
Yes, and of course I'll have two gardening magazines to give away later in the program, ABC Gardening Australia magazine and ABC Organic Gardener. This is your program, 1300 222 891. We'll be taking your calls right through until 9:30 this morning, and please remember that Sophie's advice is of a general nature and should not be taken as personal professional advice.
This is Talkback Gardening with Sophie Thompson and Troy Sincock.
Filling in for Deb Tribe on 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And Matt Coulter is the Botanic Gardens and State Herbarium of South Australia horticultural curator, otherwise known as Big Daddy. How are you, Matt?
Morning, Troy. Morning, Sophie. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Matt. Now, there's something very special in a sort of hideous way about to happen in at the Botanic Gardens, in at the Bicentennial Conservatory of the Botanic Gardens. Tell us all about it, Matt.
Yeah, so as people may know, we've got the Titanarum, also known as the corpse flower, but yeah, botanically it's Morphophallus titanum, and it's a plant from the endemic to the Sumatran rainforest, and it's this plant that really people just are incredibly fascinated by, it, including myself. It's just a really amazing plant. And I've been working on this plant for the last sort of 18 years. I started with the garden in 2007, received three seeds back in 2006, and my colleague at the time, Tina Milanovic, germinated those three seeds. And then from those three seeds, we've actually been able to create quite a collection. But yeah, at the moment, we have a live stream on the flower as well, if people wanted to log on and have a look, by our website.
Yep.
But yeah, it's such an incredible plant. So many different stories to tell. But look, the smell is one story, but yeah, there's just so many other stories, like the speed that it grows, the size of the tuber, the lichen mimicry. Yeah, it's just one of these plants that's just so fascinating. I've just been enthralled by it my whole career.
So let's just explain first. So this is the largest flower in the world, have I got that right, or the largest inflorescence in the world?
Yes. So it's classified as the largest unbranched inflorescence. So the largest single flower is the Rafflesia, which people may know occurs in Indonesia and Borneo as well. But this is actually a lot bigger. But because it's a collection of flowers, we classify it as an inflorescence. But some botanists actually classify it as the largest flower, some classify it as the largest inflorescence. But because it has multiple flowers,
yep,
we say it's the largest inflorescence of any plant in the world. And the record in the wild is almost 4 metres tall, like 3.8 metres, which is just, like, amazing.
And so this flower that's about to flower, now it's been called Smelony. I did suggest a name. I suggested Big Mama because this plant is one of the ones that's, you know, given rise to lots of pups that have gone all over the place. But Smelony, how tall do you reckon she'll be when she eventually opens?
Yeah, she's sitting about close to 1.8 metres tall now, and people have to sort of understand that that's all happened in about 10 weeks. So if you would have seen this plant 10 weeks ago, it would have actually been below the soil.
And the
amazing thing, in the last sort of week and a half, it grows anywhere from 7 centimetres to 15 centimetres in a 24-hour period, and it's grown a metre in about 2 weeks.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Given that there's a live stream, I was sort of thinking, well, there's not much to see here. Surely it's very slow. But how spectacular is the bloom? And if you're watching on the live stream, can you literally see it happening?
Once the flower starts to open, you will be, if you sort of just concentrate on the space, which is the bit that opens, you can actually almost see it move. It happens that quick. So generally what I'll do is, in time between 12 PM and 2 PM on the date it's going to open, I'll be able to tell it's going to open just by some different parameters. It was almost like clockwork, because that flower needs to open to be fully open by the night time. So to bring the pollinators to it. So it's quite amazing, from not being open at all to being fully open in like a 5 or 6 hour period. It's quite incredible to watch the process.
So if someone looks at the live stream now, they just see this pale green spadix. It's mm-hmm. it's a, you know, a big pointy thing that sticks up out of the pot, because it's in a pot.
Yes.
But correct. When it opens, describe the flower for people that mightn't be able to get in there.
So you'll see the spadix, and then it's wrapped around by what we call a space, which is a modified leaf. And when that starts to open, inside it is actually this dark purple, almost black colouring of the space, which is another indicator actually to draw the insects to it. They think it's actually a dead animal.
Mm-hmm.
So the smell is actually bringing the pollinator to it, because this plant, even though it has male and female flowers, it cannot pollinate itself. So the first night that it opens, the female flowers are active, but the male is not. And then the second night they swap over. So in the wild, the plant exudes this aroma to actually bring the insect that might have pollen from a separate flower to come to it. But the colour is also another indicator to bring the insects to it. And any time we flower one of these, it basically just gets covered in blowflies. It's just, yeah, it's quite amazing to see.
And this whole process, you know, the first night the scent is the most strong, but within 48 hours it's more or less done, isn't it?
Correct. So the first night that it opens is the only night that it can actually get pollinated. So if that was in the wild, that's the night that can get pollinated. So the plant could grow for, you know, 10 years, just growing a leaf every year and getting bigger and bigger. And then that one night actually has the chance to get pollinated. And if it doesn't get pollinated that night, then, you know, you could be looking at another 3 to 5 years again before it has that opportunity. So the plant puts all this energy into creating this smell to bring the insects. So in the wild, they're probably only, they grow like maybe 4 or 5 kilometres away from each other. So
yeah.
they never grow together. So it's actually the aroma's going out into the forest, you know, anywhere up to 4 or 5 kilometres away.
Where do you live, Troy?
I was going to say,
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the aroma, it actually pulses. So sometimes you could actually be further away from the flower and smell it stronger than right next to it. So every about 30, 60 seconds, the actually plant is actually pulsing this aroma up and out away from the flower.
And doesn't the flower temperature get to 37 degrees as part of this pulsing? So, you know, it's the most incredibly, I'm not going to say engineered, but like all plants, they are incredible. Every detail is designed so that plant can proliferate.
It's just so fascinating, isn't it, Sophie, that all the energy that this plant puts in, and yeah, it's just such a fascinating plant. I suppose that's why I've been so enthralled with it over the journey. That yeah, it's just like the thing that a plant can do. This. The other really interesting thing is, when it's in a leaf phase, it produces this thing which we call lichen mimicry. It doesn't actually make the stem look like lichen, so the animals stay away from it.
So
all the stories about this plant is just quite incredible.
And so the idea of that is that the trunk is sort of mottled, and so the idea of that is that the insects or plant creatures that might otherwise eat a soft, fleshy plant mm-hmm. think it's a woody trunk. And so that lichen mm-hmm. is distracting them, so they go, I won't bother eating that. You know, so nature is just awesome. Now, we should talk about the context of this plant in the wild, because it's a threatened plant, and that's why all the propagation you're doing is like work zoos do to support populations of threatened things.
That's right, Sophie. So like when we try and conserve plants, we usually seed bank them. So, but this plant, a lot of rainforest plants can't be seed banked. So what we need to do is actually save pollen to do like a pollination in the future. And prior to 2018, on the IUCN red list, this plant was listed as a vulnerable species. But since 2018, when it was evaluated last, it's actually been upgraded to being endangered. So, and back in 2018, it was sort of thought maybe there was like 1,000 plants left, but that's probably even a lot less now because it hasn't been evaluated since then. And it only comes from a very small area, like maybe 100, 200 kilometres circumference where it actually occurs. And so, the seed one in the wild is actually quite rare, but they are incredibly endangered, and there's lots of, you know, things like poaching and palm oil plantations, which is, you know, impinging on the survival as well. So,
and climate change.
Climate change,
and illegal logging. These are all things that make this plant so vulnerable. Now, you have been leading the way in sharing this plant, you know, A, in understanding how to grow it, but then to propagate it.
Yeah, so the propagation was really interesting because we had those three plants from 2006 and they're notoriously difficult to grow. So I wanted to safeguard the collection, so I set up a trial in 2013 just to see whether I could propagate, and I read some articles about, you know, there's possibly that you could do it by leaf cutting. There was really no information out there about it, so I just gave it a go, and it was highly successful. So from those leaf cuttings, we actually produced 100 new plants. And some of those plants have flowered for our organisation, but not for our, just for our organisation. We've donated material to other botanic gardens within Australia, and some of that leaf cuttings have flowered there as well, which is really exciting for us. So, and then about 18 months ago, we had in the nursery, we had two flowers 2 days apart, which would have been ideal in the wild. So my colleague Danny and I came in at midnight to actually do some hand pollination, like what the insects would have done. So, and from that, we've actually created another 150 seedlings. So our collection now numbers anywhere from 200 to 250 plants. Wow. When you think there's only 1,000 in the wild, that's quite an effort.
Yeah, we've got am I right in understanding that what you've created is the largest collection in Australia and one of the largest in the world?
Yeah, there's no doubt it's by far the biggest collection in Australia, and it would probably be one of the biggest in the world collected on one site, if not the actually biggest.
Well done, Matt. Well, now let's talk about the experience of people coming in to see Smelanie, because we know a lot of people are going to come, and it's actually inside the Bicentennial Conservatory, and so there will be queues, but there, you know, the Botanic Gardens has been really working hard to make sure that, you know, there's toilets and all sorts of things available. So tell people what they can expect when they come in.
Yes, anytime one of these flowers, it always gathers interest from the public, and wherever they flower, you know, we always have these issues of having to line up. But I think the Bicentennial Conservatory is one of the best. Like, once you get in the conservatory, you can actually see the plant from a distance, and you're coming down the bridge and you can see it from, you know, from a while away, whereas a lot of other places you wait outside, you go and see the flower, then you go out. So I think that experience for Adelaide is really quite special. And this year we've put a lot of effort into making a better event. So this is our fifth showing to the public. And this year, you know, we're going to have Indonesian musicians. We're going to have activities for children to do colouring in. We've got some caricatures of the flower. We're going to have lots of staff involved. So, and yeah, I think it's going to be a really good experience for people. But unfortunately, because it's, you know, everyone wants to see it for such a short period, there will be times where people might have to line up. But we're sort of really trying to make it a good experience and put into place some of the things that we've done in the past, but make it an improvement. And we've got lots of staff involved, you know, doing all this kind of stuff, which, you know, I'm really appreciative of, because, like, you know, I grow the plant, but one of the best things for me is actually to show it to the public what a fantastic species this plant is. But there will be toilets available, there'll be some catering as well. So, yeah, we're really putting a lot of effort into making it a great experience for people to come and see. But, and yeah, definitely have to line up, unfortunately.
Yeah, now tell us the big question that we're all waiting. I mean, I came to town yesterday and I stayed in town overnight thinking I was coming in to help out this morning, and got a text last night, Sophie, it's not open yet.
Yeah. So, well, it's quite interesting because people may not be aware that these plants aren't grown in the Adelaide Botanic Garden. We have a nursery in the Mount Lofty Botanic Garden where we grow them in a special climate-controlled glasshouse, and then we have to move it down to Adelaide. So about 2 weeks ago, we moved this plant down so we could show it to the public. Mm-hmm. So in actually moving it, sometimes it sets the clock off a little bit. So, but in the past, once growing in the nursery, I've almost been able to predict to the exact day. But I think that moving it sort of... just resets it a little bit. So it's been a few days out. But it's notoriously difficult to actually predict to the exact day. But all the parameters showing it's within the next few days that it should open.
So when, though? When will this process start? When do you think, you know, are we talking tomorrow afternoon? So Sunday afternoon?
It's really difficult to put to a swimming jacket today.
But I'm that's going like a politician answer, Matt.
That's it, yeah. So about 2 weeks ago, I predicted it would have been yesterday, but I think it's going to be a couple of days out. But I mean, it could be any day. It could be today. Yeah. It could be tomorrow.
When it starts, we've got 2 days, right? It's basically people are going to be able to see something for 2 days. So the best thing, if people want to keep in tune with what's going on, is to look at the live stream on YouTube.
I mean, our social media, as soon as we find out it's going to flower, we'll be putting that information in our social media channels as well.
Yep.
But if people want to look, hook onto the live stream, you'll definitely see what's happening at that moment. But as soon as we find out, then our social media team will kick in and get all that information out. And I usually between 12 and 2 o'clock, I'll go and check it, and that's the time frame it should start to open.
Yep.
And then what we're doing, the 2 days that we're going to open to midnight for people to actually see it. And actually to see it at nighttime is something special.
I bet.
That's when it looks and smells the best. And it's quite remarkable to see the space fully open. It's dark, freely space, and it looks really amazing. And then, if people are really interested in the RAM of that sort of 10 o'clock to midnight, so really a strong sort of smell at that time. So, but we in the past, we've opened it to 1 day to midnight, but, our organisations have agreed to open it for 2 nights to midnight. So, we're really excited by that.
That's great, Matt. We've had some texters saying, grow more because, we want to be able to see these in many different places. But there was some suggestion during the week. It's a shame they grow at a distance because the idea of having three together, not only Smellany, but Smelcom and Sniffany. You could have like a trio.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah.
And I love the fact that you're checking on it, all the time. It's like an expectant father, right? When's the baby coming? When's the baby ready? So, well, it's going to be an amazing experience for people. And so thank you, Matt, for, all the work you've done to produce these. And, your babies have gone to Sydney Botanic Gardens and Geelong Botanic Gardens, and I can't remember the number of people that went to see it in Sydney. How many was that, Matt?
I think it might have been like in excess of 50,000.
Jeez.
Yeah, so your grandbaby or whatever we call it, your progeny have brought huge crowds. So well done, Matt. It's always great to talk with you. I mean, I've talked with Matt about Wallamai Pines. Matt's talked about paper daisies. Matt's been a regular guest, but this is something very special. So if there's any way you can get to the Botanic Gardens, if you're there queuing during the day, be sensible. Take a hat, have a water bottle, and if you're going to go at night, the queues might be a couple of hours, but what an experience. Can I tell you, the Botanic Gardens at night is magnificent there's a magical feeling to it. There's been all these events on in the Botanic Gardens and, there'll be information on the Botanic Gardens website about how to find out about it. I should do a disclaimer. I am totally biased. Not only did I grow up with the Botanic Gardens and I love it, I am on the board.
Well, I got to say, we're all getting so excited. I thought I was excited to see David Byrne from Talking Heads next weekend. I'm more excited to see the corpse flower bloom, I think.
Absolutely. So thank you so much, Matt, for sharing with our listeners. And we'll look forward to, hearing how many people go to visit. And can I say, this is a free event. You can go and see this amazing plant. If you feel generous to support the work that the Botanic Gardens is doing for seed, for supporting plants that are threatened and endangered, please feel free to make a donation.
Good on you, Matt. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thanks for your kind words. I appreciate it.
That's Matt Coulters from the Botanic Gardens, and he is the horticultural curator at the Botanic Gardens and State Herbarium of South Australia. That does sound incredibly exciting. We mentioned the current corpse flower is called Smellany. There are other ideas like Smelcom and Sniffany. A text message, Smelissa.
Smelissa, I love it.
It's really great. 1-300-222-891 is the telephone number on ABC Talkback Gardening. Sophie Thompson here until 9:30 this morning. This is your show. Did the corpse flower in Sydney have a name?
It did. It was called Putricia. And, I love the fact that we give plants names.
Yeah.
I actually inherited a a cycad from a friend, and it was her mother's flower, and she couldn't really, it was a bit prickly and it didn't fit in the spot, and I took it home, and that plant's called Kim, and I recently sent my friend a picture of Kim because she put on a whole new ring of foliage and performing better for me than she did for her, and it was her mother's plant, so.
Wow. 1-300-222-891 is the telephone number to speak to Sophie, and just before we get to Joe from Athelstan, I would say, you know, you could hear just that, you know, your passion, Matt's passion, and, you know, all of a sudden I'm getting excited in something I had no knowledge of. I suppose things like the corpse flower too are just such a great gateway, aren't they, in the same way that, you know, 2020 cricket can have people, you know, go to the cricket rather than feeling like they've got to sit there for 5 days wondering what's going on. Same thing for the Botanic Gardens, right? This might just be the thing that gets someone to the Adelaide Botanic Gardens.
Absolutely. And the Botanic Gardens is, you know, it's amazing. If you just have got a little bit of free time any day and you're in town, go into the gardens. You know, the collection of trees there is amazing. The science that goes on there is amazing. The wetlands there are amazing. The Museum of Economic Botany is amazing. The one of the things I love, and it's recently been revamped, is the Mediterranean Garden. Mm-hmm. So it's in the centre of the gardens. It's got a beautiful water rill. It's got the two wisteria arbors on either side. So if, you know, you go, oh, my garden really got trashed by the heat, you know, how can I learn about what I should be growing? Now, unfortunately, nurseries don't always carry all these plants or plant retailers, shall I say, don't carry these plants. Go along there and look at these plants. They're from a similar climate to our own and they are surviving and thriving.
Wonderful. It's 8 to 9. Joe from Athelstan, are you looking to re-establish a worm farm?
Yeah, good morning, guys. Yeah, what's happened is I think I lost it in the heat wave we had the other week.
Yep.
And I've been putting my food scraps in there and I'm looking at the food scraps and they're still there. I'm wondering what the hell's going on. I've still got the compost, but it doesn't look like I've got any worms.
So one of the challenges with worm farms is they're black, and if they're in a sunny position, they get really hot, and worms are obviously very sensitive to the heat. So for the future, if anyone's – I mean, I actually had a friend that used to take her worm farm into her laundry when it got really hot. Now, she probably knew her worms' names too, and it's a little bit heavy, so I'm not going to suggest you do that. So you need to make sure that the worm farm is in a really cool, shady spot. If you're going to make your own, making them out of an old fridge is a great idea because it's insulated. So then the other thing is when it is going to be a heat wave and you know that you've got hot, you know, a hot position, you can do things like freeze some an ice block, you know, like a milk bottle or something like that, and put that in, and that will keep the temperature down, or put, you know, some a jute matting or an old blanket, an old woolen blanket, wet it down and put it on top, and that will act as insulation. So do have a look through your worm farm, Joe. If all the worms have passed away, you might have to invest in some more worms, and you can buy them from the hardware stores or things like that. You can also usually buy them from community gardens. Often community gardens will sell small containers of them to reintroduce them. But, yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges is after a heat wave is worms will die off. So if you're, you know, let's say your worm farm's sitting on the pavers by the back door, or, you know, pavers, walls, all those things are going to make the temperature 10 to 15 degrees hotter than the actual temperature. So you might need to reposition it somewhere it's cool. And do Google. If you're interested in making your own, making one out of an old fridge, I remember years ago visiting the Wyala High School and they had a worm farm they'd made out of an old fridge, and it was on the western side of a huge shed. And we were there in February, I think, and the guy admitted that he'd completely forgotten about the worm farm over school holidays. And I just gasped because I thought of, you know, worm carnage. And then he said, and I got back after school holidays, opened it, and they were still there because they were insulated in that worm farm.
So what I love about this is, you know, people ringing for advice, you can think you're in a perilous situation, and the answer can be so simple. It's just a matter of knowing where to go to get the answer.
Absolutely. So good luck with that, Joe.
Thanks for your call, Joe. 1-300-222-891. Peter's at Tumby Bay. What's happening with your peacherine, Peter?
Yeah, good morning, Sophie and Troy. The peacherine, like the fruit's ripening as we speak. If you pick them, you know, just when they're ready to eat, put them on the kitchen bench, and their shelf life is only like 1 to 2 days, and then they're rotting from the inside out.
Okay, so can I tell you what can cause this? Now, it mightn't be, but when we have a heat wave, if that plant stresses for water, the stone inside heats up and it actually cooks the first layer of flesh around the seed. So it's happened with me with apricots once when we just had at the wrong time, and so then it starts to go rotten and then you get all sorts of bugs going in there, you know, because they're looking to eat the rotting flesh. So it's whether, you know, it's all that, all about timing. When you know there's a heat wave coming, you know, you might have had a set routine, you water your fruit trees once a week or, you know, on a Sunday. If you know the heat wave's coming on the Saturday, you almost want to make sure you've watered well on the Friday so the plants are hydrated before the heat wave gets there. So that's what I would put it down to. Because we had that heat wave, I don't know what your, well, heat spike, whatever we want to call it. I don't know how hot you got that day, Peter, but if the plant was slightly dry going into that, that could cause it.
I watered it 2 days before the 42-degree day. And the other thing is when you break the fruit open, there's small white maggots in there.
Oh, okay. So I would be getting onto the fruit fly site and looking up and seeing if they are matching that. So PRRSA are very interested, of course, in fruit fly, and we need to manage that and keep our state as safe as we can. So get onto the website and look up and contact them.
Thanks for your call, Peter. It is 3 minutes to nine on ABC Talkback Gardening with Sophie Thompson. We were talking about Smelony, the corpse flower, in the Bicentennial Conservatory. The one in Sydney was called Putricia. People are really getting creative now, Sophie. What about Enrico?
Oh!
Reek. My goodness, that reeks. And Susan from Port Lincoln's getting creative too. What about Smelody?
Smelody. Yeah, oh my goodness. We could even have a song about this.
We need to create like 10 corpse flowers. We've got names for them all. All right, let's see if we can squeeze in Marg from Morfett Vale. Hello, Marg, how can we help you?
Yes, no, it's just with regarding our apricot tree that we have. We've got a lot of fruit on it this season, which is lovely, but a lot of the fruit's covered with like a scale or a brown scab that develops on the fruit really early before it ripens. I'm just wondering what might be causing that.
Okay, so that can be a fungal issue, and you can treat that, but not now. You know, when the plant's dormant, and you know, use a fungicide to treat that. It is actually called scale, but it's not a scale as in, you know, like a scale on your indoor plant or something like that. So at the moment, there's not much you can do with it. The fruit is still edible when it ripens, but it can look a bit unsightly.
Good on you, Marg. Thanks so much for being part of the program. And you can do the same on ABC Talkback Gardening with Sophie Thompson. My name's Troy Sincock, filling in for Deb Tribe for the next couple of weeks. All you got to do is get on the phone. 1-300-222-891 is the telephone number, or you can SMS us anytime on 0467-922-891. I'm learning so much this morning. There's been a lot of references to rotting flesh. I never thought that was going to happen.
Well, and ultimately anything rotting, you know, just put it in the compost and you grow a better garden. You know, we have had a number of calls at times about planting things in the bottom of the hole to get your passion fruit growing.
People have been really enjoying coming up with some names for, you know, the next corpse flowers, mm-hmm. or if we add a few more to the botanic gardens. Ella Smeller. Or Ricky Gervais. Oh. Oda Winfrey.
Oh, that's good.
That's another suggestion from Alex at Broadview. Or Smell Gibson.
Awesome. I love it. I love it. Well, you know, I do look forward to hearing next week everyone's experiences. So.
Exactly, which hopefully shouldn't be too far away. Also, Sarah from Glenelg South says, I have a mini worm farm in my kitchen. I feed it a handful of scraps every 2 days and they thrive. I haven't named them yet as they're about 2,000. But talking about
really?
Yeah, talking about worms, we've had a message about where can you buy garden worms?
Okay, so it's really interesting. There are two, I mean, there's lots of different types of worms. But basically there are two groups of worms. There's garden worms, earthworms, which mm-hmm. are in the soil in your veggie patch when you're digging and you might see them, and then there are compost worms. Now, you can buy compost worms. They are gross feeders. You can't buy compost worms and put them in your garden. They'll starve to death. Compost worms go in your worm farm or in your compost bin. Now, earthworms... worms you can't buy. You actually have to attract them. And how you attract them is by putting organic matter in your soil. And basically add organic matter and the earthworms will find your garden. And there's nothing more exciting than when you start gardening somewhere and the soil's pretty poor and you add organic matter and then you see an earthworm. You know, I'm sure someone around our property would have heard me scream for joy when I saw my first earthworm in an abandoned property that, you know, wouldn't – where basically who knows where they were because it was 4 years of not being watered or anything.
Yeah.
And then I added and improved the soil and then I found earthworms. So, wow. So exciting.
What a victory. 1-300-222-891. In the next half hour too, I have two gardening magazines to give away, an ABC Gardening Australia magazine and an ABC Organic Gardener magazine. I'll tell you when to call for that. But Maggie from Mile End has called us now. How can Sophie help you this morning, Maggie?
Yeah, good morning. I have 15 backyard bliss lily pillies.
Beautiful.
In a row in my backyard.
Yep.
I've been hedging them. They're about 20 months old, so I reckon they went in May of 2024, probably 1.3 metres in height. Uh-huh. And I hedge them like within an inch of their life every probably month or so, so I take off the little tips of that.
Yep.
But do I hedge it where they're touching the ground, their lowest branches are actually touching the ground so they have a little stem or not?
So I would actually leave the foliage to the ground, right? You know, there's no reason to have a gap down there. And if you see it, I think it's going to look a bit weird. I have seen some hedges where they've actually taken the lower bit off, but that was in areas where frost was a big issue, which is not an issue for you. And the reason they took the lower foliage of a hedge off is so the frost could keep flowing away, because frost is like invisible lava and it flows. And if you've got a hedge to the ground and it traps the frost, you can get more damage. But in your case, I would just do the tops and the sides.
Okay. Cool.
Or the front, actually. And can I say it's looking very good there? I love the fact you sent a photo, Maggie. Good on you.
No worries. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your call. Graham's at Blackwood. Your mulberry trees are coming in a range of colours, Graham.
Yes, but I've got two different mulberry trees. One is just the normal mulberry, which is quite a black mulberry. The other one is what I think is called white mulberry, which looks like a worm. It hangs.
Yep.
What interests me is that the birds are very, very keen on the black mulberry, but they don't touch the long one, the wormy-looking one, and that's as sweet as anything. I just don't understand why a bird wouldn't take that mulberry but will take all the others or even any other fruit I've got around. So I'm just wondering if there's something wrong with the mulberry. We shouldn't be eating it either.
No. Well, actually, I think it's got less flavour. White mulberries are incredibly sweet, but they don't have the flavour of the black ones. So, you know, whether the birds are just going to go for the black ones, I think when the black ones, you know, if they're all gone, they'll find the white ones. That would be my gut feel because they, you know, they're quite intelligent. But they'd go, why would I go with that one? I much prefer the black one because the black mulberries have the most incredible intense flavour. So you could wait and see if they go for the white ones too. Or you could just be proactive and get netting.
They'll go to the apples and the pears and the quinces, but they won't go for the white ones. I don't understand that.
Well, interesting, isn't it? We probably need a bird expert or someone like James Smith to answer that one for us. But, yeah, so they don't, you know, they're very sweet, but they don't have the flavour. So.
Thank you very much for your call, Graham. Appreciate you being part of the show. You can do the same, 1-300-222-891. Aaron is from Haybra. How can you revive an umbrella plant? That's your question, Aaron.
Yeah, it's a bit of an emotional one because we inherited this plant off of our lovely neighbours who both passed away quite recently.
Okay.
And we really want to keep it alive. I did send through a couple of photos.
Yeah, I can see it. Now, where have you got it growing? Is it under a veranda or something?
Yeah, it is. We put it under our pergola. It was under theirs, which was the whole lot was laser light roofing.
Yep.
And then shade cloth around the side. It obviously didn't get watered for 3 or 4 months, pretty much.
Yep.
And we put it out the back straight under our pergola. I don't think it was getting enough light or we were watering it too much.
So can you tell me, your pergola, which way does it face?
It faces south.
Okay, that's good. So it doesn't actually get sun in on it. They don't need much sun. How often are you watering it?
The wife waters it because I'm away at work all the time. I think she's watering it once every 3 days.
Okay, I don't think it's actually getting enough, believe it or not.
Nah.
Right? So my rule of thumb is you aim to water plants daily. Now, if you miss, you know, and it goes, you know, every second day, you'll get away with it. But in that hot weather, you know, those winds we've had, that plant has got a lot of leaves. So all those leaves are pumping out moisture, basically, transpiring. And so when we have hot weather, now, can I tell you, an umbrella plant is as tough as old boots. So what you might like to do is get some organic fertilizer, a bit of seaweed-based plant tonic, put it around the pot. If you're worried it's being overwatered, like if you put your finger in the ground in the soil and the water is hanging around and the soil is soggy, it might mean that it's blocked the holes underneath. So you could lift it on some little pot feet or a couple of bricks that you can't see, just to make sure the water's penetrating properly. But I would say you'd need to water it more often. And when you water it, because it might have dried out because it wasn't watered for a couple of months, you know, make sure that you've got the water soaking that root ball thoroughly. Put a lot of water in, even a bit of soil wetter to make sure the root ball gets hydrated, and then water it more regularly.
Thanks so much for your call, Aaron. 1300 222 891. A few more suggestions for corpse flower names. How's Pugh Grant or Smelvin Bragg? And Carol at Lenswood said, I've got a name for the corpse flower, Lukey Pukey.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, Sue's from West Beach. Hello, Sue. How's your apricot tree going? Are you there, Sue? Sue,
hello.
I can. Yes, there you are. How's your apricot tree?
Oh, interesting. I just wanted to ask Sophie, I found these little craters in the apricots, only small little craters. And I thought, what on earth is going on here? So out to the apricot tree I go. And then there's ladybirds. All these little craters have got ladybirds sitting in them.
Okay, and they're really ladybirds? They're not harlequin bugs?
No, no, I know the difference. They're the beautiful little ladybirds. And they're not doing any harm to the fruit. They just seem to be sheltering in the skin in their little craters.
Okay, well, something has made that crater. Is the crater weeping, or is it just a little sealed-off hole?
It's not even a hole, and it's not weeping. It's just a very small indentation into the skin, and the ladybirds are sitting in them.
Oh, go them. Well, they obviously, you know, love the smell of apricot. Nothing like, you know, the smell of a ripe apricot. You know, if they're there, they're sheltering, they're not doing any harm. Whether there were some insect pests on the tree that they moved there for, I don't know. But, you know, whenever you see ladybirds, rejoice.
I do, yes.
Yeah. Good on you, Sue. I don't know why that is, and interesting, but, you know, I love ladybirds will turn up in the most extraordinary places. I've had lots of ladybirds in some of the saltbush ground covers I have in my orchard, and that's why I planted them, hoping they'd come, and I've had two different types of ladybirds. One's an insectivorous ladybird, so it eats insect pests, and the other one is a fungus-eating ladybird, so it eats fungal issues, you know. So good on you, Sue. You've obviously got a good garden to have ladybirds in abundance.
Yeah, I really love the idea of having that garden. You know, we were talking about perfumes earlier, you know, the perfumes and all these insects, you're bringing birds in. You really just can create a very vibrant environment, can't you, with a little bit of knowledge?
Absolutely. Now, Troy, I want to ask.
Yes.
What's your garden like?
Not that great. In fact, I don't have one, and I only have indoor plants, and they are they're always sort of on the edge. I feel like they're going to fade, and then miraculously, certainly through no effort of my own, it's more luck than anything, they'll come back to life. And I'm not wonderful with that.
Well, you've got a lot on, but, you know, I do. Indoor plants are amazing, and if you've got a house that is light, they just bring life to rooms.
Yes,
you know, where I am out in the desert, the biggest challenge to my indoor plants is dust. And because I have so many of them, Well, that might be the state of my house. And because I have so many of them, you know, one friend puts all her plants in the shower, you know, that would take me a day to do that. So I'm not doing that enough. So I'm hoping as I get the gardeners around the house established, the dust decreases.
Well, just quickly, what is the concern about dust? I mean, their plants are in dirt.
Dust actually blocks their ability to photosynthesize, right?
Really?
You know, because, you know, too much dust is not good for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, theoretically, so I get there with a pair of old socks that I wet down and I wipe their leaves and, you know, you won't see me doing dusting on the furniture, but I will do it on the plants.
That sounds about right. 17 past 9 on ABC Talkback Gardening. Mary's from Victor Harbour. How can Sophie help you?
I have two weed problems. One, the robinia that you mentioned the other week. I've got one, a sucker that's come up in the garden, and I'm just wondering what to put on it.
Oh, is it attached to the tree still? Have you still got the tree?
The tree was next door about 30 metres away 10 years ago.
And so the tree's gone?
Oh, yeah, it's a long time.
Okay. So you know, then now whether you do this or you get someone in to do it, you need to get a woody weed killer or a tree killer. And you need to read the instructions. These things are quite toxic. You have to be careful when you do it. And you need to cut and swab that plant like they do with feral weeds like olives that are on the hillsides or things like that. And so that will kill that sucker of the robinia. So what's your other weed, Mary?
Oyster plant. I dug up an oyster plant because it was spreading like mad. And bits of it keep coming up.
Yeah. You know, if Peter Gers was here, he'd tell you to move house, right? That was one of his standard responses. You know, one weed issue, well, you can possibly deal with, but two, I mean, oyster plant, acanthus, in the right spot is a great plant, right? It's a Mediterranean plant. It takes severe root competition. You know, we could go in the botanic gardens and see mass beds of it under these ancient trees and it survives and it's climate compatible. But it is invasive, and if you've got it where you don't want it, it is pretty hard to get rid of, and you might not be able to get rid of it.
Mm.
You know, you could try and keep on digging it, but I think it's going to keep on coming. You might actually have to resort to herbicide. But, you know, my number one thing is I would only, if someone's listening, only ever put it in where it can't get out of control and where it's got incredible root competition and dry shade, and it's the perfect plant for it.
Another apricot tree question from you, Robert.
Yes, it's actually Brahma Lodge, not Brown Lodge.
Oh, okay. I was wondering what I thought you were in some idyllic location I'd never heard about.
Oh, yeah, down by the sea, no wonder.
Yeah.
Look, I want to prune my summer prune my apricot tree today, but with the hot weather tomorrow, is that advisable?
Can I say I would just wait? And actually, I've looked ahead and we're due to have hot weather, and I think on Friday too. I don't know that it's showing beyond that. So, you know, you can take up to 30% off your tree. You know, you do it on a clear, dry day. That's perfect. So the wounds will heal. You use clean secateurs and you disinfect them between cuts. However, what's going to happen is when you cut that foliage off, the foliage underneath may well get sunburnt if tomorrow. So I would be holding off if you can. If you could do it, like, let's say if we go back a week, you know, if you could do it at the start of last week, you know, then you know you've got 5 days of mildish weather and the leaves will toughen up. Yeah, so I would try and hold off if you can, Robert. And ultimately, if you say, look, this is the only day I can do it, you then have to be proactive to prevent sunburn. So you use seaweed-based plant tonics, right? They increase the plant's resistance to heat and drought stress. You could even water them on and use that anti-transpirant, which acts as sunscreen for the plants.
Right. And when should I fertilise? Because I did summer prune last year and fertilised and it just took off again. So I don't want to be doing that.
Well, I would be doing autumn feeding, really. And, you know, organic-based fertiliser in autumn and spring would be my, you know, base feeding regime.
Thanks very much for your call, Robert from Brahma Lodge, not Brown Lodge, as we as we've just discovered. Annie from Strathalbyn, thanks so much for your message as well. She refers to us both as intelligent, interesting, and switched on. Now, no one's
we'll
ever said that
you
about
later.
Me. It must have been something to do with the corpse flower. I find myself so excited about things all of a sudden.
Slightly macabre, but anyway.
That's right. All right, Sandra's from Hackham. How's your lemon tree going, Sandra?
Yeah, good morning. It's a friend's lemon tree, and it's in a lawn, a kaikuyu lawn, and it doesn't typically get the amount of water that it should. And the lemons this year are soft, and they're dropping off the tree. And so I'm not sure what's going on with it.
Okay, have you seen them? Have you seen the lemons?
Yes, I have. Yes,
so,
I...
So are they sort of rotten, or are they because there is a, you know, some lemons can actually get like a fungal issue on them. You know, are they, should they have been harvested? Are they old lemons or?
No, they get to size, they get to the right colour, but they're just dropping off the tree, and they're, instead of being a nice firm lemon,
yep,
they're a bit, if you squeeze them, they're a bit soft to touch.
Okay, so I think they're just dry, okay? So the rule of thumb with citrus trees, this is the Ian Tolley thing, you know they're dry when you touch the leaf of the tree on a warm day and the leaf is not cool to the touch. So the leaf should be cool to the touch. Now what's going to happen is if the tree is short of water, the first thing it's going to do is it's going to ease its load. So it will drop those lemons, okay? And if they're not juicy, they're not going to be firm. You know, if there's not enough water in them, if there's not enough liquid in them, they're not going to be firm. So kikuyu is a beast. If you can try and make a ring around the tree that you can try and exclude the kikuyu, so, you know, and I would talk about a metre around the tree. Is so that's 2 metres across. If you can try and rip it out, now that's going to be an ongoing thing. Maybe you put cardboard or newspaper down and cover it with mulch. And so then the kikuyu is not taking the moisture from the tree as much and keeping, you know, in the old days I know we used to talk about you put a sprinkler under your lemon tree and you wait till you put the sprinkler on. You're trying to put an inch to an inch and a half of water in a cup, right? So, you know, it's a really good long soak to get that. So I would just pick up the water, Sandra.
Thank you very much for your call. 1-300-222-891 is the telephone number to call if you'd like to win one of two gardening magazines we have to give away. We've got the ABC Gardening Australia magazine and the ABC Organic Gardener. We're going to take a couple of calls at random, so give us a buzz. 1-300-222-891 on ABC Talkback Gardening. I'm here with Sophie Thompson. And the last call for the day comes from Chris at Fullerton. How is your crepe myrtle, Chris?
Well, my crepe myrtle's not flowering, to be honest.
Oh.
Got what I think looks to be quite a healthy crepe myrtle that's been in the ground for about 3 years now. It's about 8 to 10 foot tall, but each year I see beautiful crepe myrtles flowering all around the suburbs of Fullerton and Adelaide, and mine does not flower, or I get one or two buds very late in the season.
Okay.
So what am I doing wrong?
So can you tell me what variety it is? It's not one called Tonto, is it?
So it's a white flower. When I do see them, it's white. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, so then it's not Tonto. It might have been Natchez. Is it meant to grow into a tree, or is it just a shrubby one?
No, into a tree. So it's got a, you know, standalone trunk, and then I'm trying to each year I prune it back just a little bit to promote new growth. But it's, you know, it's a healthy tree style. Yeah.
And is it in full sun?
Yeah, pretty much. It doesn't get late sun because this is on the eastern side of the house, but it's getting mostly full sun throughout the day, yes.
Okay. So when you prune it, how much are you taking off?
In the first couple of years, I probably went a little bit light, but maybe, 10 to 20% down, but still keeping those structural limbs to try and get some shape to it.
Okay. I don't know why it's not flowering, Chris. We've asked you all the questions. I don't bother pruning crepe myrtles because they don't need it. They will flower every year without it. In the old days, the practice with crepe myrtles was to pollard them, where they used to prune them really hard, and you ended up with these trees that, to me, have arthritic fingers because they've got all this woody growth and, you know, spindly stuff coming off. So I don't bother pruning. So I'd actually tell you not to bother pruning anymore. You know, you've got trees. I would just wait and I would feed. I don't know why they're not flowering. If it's a white one, it's probably one called Natchez, which is usually reliable. So let's cut the pruning out and see if something changes.
Okay, and what about water? Because I've asked around some gardening centres around the place. Some people say I'm watering too much. Some say I'm watering too little, or the pH of the soil. Is there anything?
No, I wouldn't worry about the pH. You're in Fullerton, you know. They are growing all around you. You know, you're probably seeing beautiful white crepe myrtles flowering within blocks of your place. So I wouldn't worry about the pH. Watering, you know, trees prefer a good deep soak less often. If you weren't watering enough, though, you would actually see burn on the end of the leaf. So I think it would be showing a sign. Maybe you are overwatering. How often do you water it?
Twice a week for about 45 minutes just on a dripper.
No, that's not too much. And you're not seeing burn on the leaves?
Right on the very tips around this time, they're starting to get a little bit brown, but it's not like overt burn. But yeah, just on the very tip, it's getting a touch brown.
Yeah, which sometimes can be a little bit of the, you know, often there's a bit of salt in the water by the end of summer, and crepe myrtles don't particularly like that. Look, I would just, after you've watered, you know, that I always try and get people to check how deep the water's penetrated. We're trying to get water 30 centimetres into the ground and around the whole root zone, not just if you're doing a drip and it's got one outlet near the trunk of the tree. That's, you know, not spreading as far as it could. But I would just stop pruning and see if the tree responds.
Chris, thank you for being the last caller of the day on ABC Talkback Gardening. Congratulations to our Gardening Magazine winners too. And I suppose, well, for the next 48 hours or so, just crossing our fingers and hoping the corpse flower blooms, Sophie.
Absolutely. I actually am loving the live stream. I thought nothing was happening. And then I saw people walk in. I see feet on the bridge behind, and know that if you stay tuned to the Botanic Gardens on social media, on their website, they will let you know when the corpse flower is out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me on ABC Talkback Gardening.
Happy gardening.